I would, got our inputs and outputs reconfigured.
Kill in.
How is it now?
It's back up.
Looking good for me. Okay.
Awesome.
All right, now I need to pop up one more of these bad boys so that I can do a record stereo.
I apologize for the dog fight that seems to be occurring in the front hallway. I don't know what's going on there.
It's you know, voting season, so we're used to hearing stuff like that.
It's calming down some, but...
I hate you guys. You kind of robbed me of my anger. A little bit.
Oops. My bad.
It's like cutting off Samson's hair.
Huh.
Wait, are you the guy in Mystery Men whose superpower is that he's a really angry dude?
That is correct, sir.
That's what they had, huh?
Oh, and I don't have my bell!
Oh, no.
I meant to bring a lot of things.
We have a bell in
here. Yeah.
1 minute warning.
1 minute warning?
Well,
okay, 3 minute warning. We kick it. Okay, 9 o'clock comes. They start doing their thing. Everything's on automatic. So when that thing says 9:02, I play a little bit of music to make sure we're covering buffer time, and then...
Yeah.
Give me!
Why did you do that?
Why did you give
Man,
him a bell?
I wish I had bought the bell at the Pottery Barn. It was like $45, but it was a bell like the one they put on a counter at a shop, except it was about a foot in diameter and made this really low tone. It's bong.
Yes.
It lasted for about a minute.
Oh, it's like a gong. Dong. We need
mm-hmm.
Oh, cool! Cell phones off, no swearing!
Hey! There we go. Albert.
2 minute warning! Yeah, 2 minute warning!
Yep. He
gave me
right,
this.
Albert's mic is now up.
It fits in my finger. It's like a ring. It's like the ring of power.
I should probably get these out of here.
That's stressing me out, like, big time.
Is this gonna break something?
We're on the radio, and I have I am afraid to mess with my soundboard right now.
What's up? Is there something already plugged
in? So this is my sound stuff.
That's it.
Is that what you're going to stab me in the leg with when I do too much?
No, I wouldn't use such a good pen like this.
Is
it's
that
a good pen.
Or am I gonna break something?
Yeah, it's practically a marker.
Is it plugged in? Yeah, I just don't want to add one. I didn't want to add more if
2 minutes.
Two-minute warning.
This is the 7 minutes of terror of the Mars entry, descent, and landing profile.
Oh, yeah. This is where everybody's just like, this is when everything is going to break. Absolutely.
We've just been conditioned to that. It's fine. Everything will be fine.
Lemon, lion. Right. Sad face, angry face, sad face, lion face.
Can we do another
face?
Check?
Okay.
Can't do it. Yeah, I'm frozen up.
I'm not in a sad mood. Angry doesn't convey to sad for me, not necessarily. Sad to angry, but that's always because anger is productive.
Probably about another 30 seconds or so.
Like a productive cough?
Or a productive set of biological activities I am not prepared to state right now because we have 1 minute and counting.
1 minute.
65 West Bridge Street. That's right. We're just going to be to the palatial administrative offices. Fountain included. Hello and welcome to the Thingularity radio program, broadcasting from the Palatial Administrative Offices of the Catskill Makers Syndicate, located at 65 West Bridge Street, right next to the Juice Branch. How is everybody doing tonight?
Yay!
Whoa. Yeah!
Okay,
great!
We are all definitely alive, and our guest tonight is Christopher Carson.
Pleased to be with you!
Yes.
He is... somebody you guys might already know because he's been on the show before. He's been a spectacular guest, and we're looking to have another good, fun night tonight. To my left is... what?
Go ahead.
No, intro, so people know who we're talking. Ben, to my left.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, Brian, hiding in the back.
Yo!
Albert, how you doing?
Hey there.
Cody?
Hi, y'all.
Hey, and Professor Vaughn, Mother's Bob.
Yo.
That is everybody, and now you kind of know what they sound like, but we will get jumbled. Anybody got anything they want to bring up tonight before we dive into the guest, or vice versa?
Whoa!
Diving into him. We won't be getting into moon colonization, I don't think.
No, that was last time.
Ooh, do we have a topic available? Anything? Anybody? Grab bag? Don't make me start pulling out random words.
I think he had a conversation starter of some kind that had to do with a mug. We don't have.
Yes, I have here, and those of you on the radio can't actually see it, which is your loss. This wonderful commemorative mug, which says Rochester Gas and Electric, world's longest commercial Westinghouse reactor run, 189 days, July 22nd, 1973. Now, for those of you who don't know about Rochester Gas and Electric, this is a commemorative mug. It's got a picture on it of the Paul R. Genet Station. Paul R. Genet Station is a single-unit nuclear power station near Rochester, as you might imagine. It is the second oldest by a month and pretty much the smallest nuclear generating unit in the United States today. The one that's a month older is actually Nine Mile Point, also in upstate New York. Hmm. Now, interesting thing about this, Paul R. Genet, who was he? Well, he was a utility executive who firmly believed in the potential of nuclear energy. He was the head of the Power Reactor Development Corporation, which built the Enrico Fermi Fast Breeder Reactor outside Detroit.
Brian?
You may have encountered a book that went by the title of We Almost Lost Detroit, which described an accident which occurred at the Enrico Fermi Fast Breeder about 1970. It should be pointed out that no one was in danger of having their city blown up or anything of that nature. Actually, the most interesting thing about it to me was that there was fuel melting and that the reactor was actually then repaired and decontaminated, repaired and returned to service, which is one of at least three incidents I know of where a sodium-cooled, liquid sodium-cooled reactor actually suffered a fuel melting accident and was repaired and returned to service, which is really quite interesting. Anyway, but...
Wait, could you tell me about when that occurred?
Right about 1970.
Okay.
The Enrico Fermi, anyway, that's a story for another day, but the Paul R. Genet Station, this is commemorating the longest commercial power run of a Westinghouse reactor, 189 days in 1973. Now, you might ask yourself, I mean, now, that was when the station was nearly new. It's over 50 years old now. It'll be 52 years old come December 10th. Surely, you know, 189 days, that's almost half a year. How is it performing nowadays? Well, if you go to the International Atomic Energy Agency's Power Reactor Information Service, you'll learn something quite interesting. Because IAEA, PRIS, that's your mouthful of letters for the day, tabulates availability factor of nuclear power units. I don't know anybody who tabulates this for any other kind of power unit, but IAEA, PRIS tabulates it for nuclear units. And Genet performs remarkably well. In 2016, in fact, it shows 100.0% availability, meaning that it ran all 365 days of that year without stopping. The previous and subsequent years, 94.9%, which tells you that they were running 18-month fuel cycles with a 90-day shutdown for refueling and regular maintenance. Anyway, so that's actually kind of amazing that this 50-year-old plus power plant is running pretty much 350 days out of the average year.
But I thought nuclear is dangerous.
I mean, is it dangerous? Well, one thing I can tell you is that this, like I say, 50-year-old power plant, which is still achieving regularly better than 90% load averages, that kind of tells me that these plants must be well-engineered, well-constructed, well-maintained, and well-operated, or otherwise they'd never be able to do that. On the other side of the lake in Ontario, right, earlier in the year, Darlington, at Darlington, one of their units came off a continuous power run of 1,102 days. Wow. Now, Genet or other U.S.-type power reactors could never do that. That's not physically feasible because they have to refuel roughly every 18 months. When they were first built, they refueled every 12 months, but the fuel handling has been modified over the years, so they refuel every 18 months, typically. Whereas the CANDU reactors they use in Canada, those are refueled continuously. So they never have to shut them down unless either something goes wrong or they have some kind of scheduled maintenance or inspection or whatever. So which is, you know, Darlington Unit 2 was shut down on schedule after 1,102 continuous days of operation.
So what you're saying is the United States did it better.
So far as I know, this is not just the longest continuous power run of a nuclear power station. It's the longest continuous power run of a steam power station of any kind ever.
And this is Mile Point.
That was Darlington. Darlington in Ontario. Like I say, across the lake.
The Canadians, not...
Okay.
Yeah. Canadians, right.
Okay.
Now, 9 Mile Point. Let's look at 9 Mile Point Unit 1, right, which is the other, like I say, Genet and 9 Mile Point 1 are the oldest and smallest nuclear units operating in this country today.
Fun fact, I grew up next to 9 Mile Point. I spent a large part of my adolescence 6 miles away from it. That cool. might explain a thing or two.
6 Mile Point.
But yeah, and so here's a fun one. According, again, to IAEA PRIS, availability of 9 Mile Point Unit 1 during 2020, 100.0%. It did not shut off either on schedule or because of a failure of equipment or anything. It ran continuously
during 2020?
The entire year of 2020.
That's the, okay. So the pandemic. So during the pandemic, it had no issues. That's okay.
As a matter of fact.
I would just like to kind of point that out.
As a matter of fact, it shows an annual load factor of 101.6%, which is to say it was actually generating more than its rated output.
Wait a minute.
Does that mean that it was getting drawn from more? Because doesn't nuclear just kind of add to the base load and then other sources come online during peak power?
So 101.6 annual load factor, what that really means is the rated load is based on a certain outdoor temperature. And so during the colder months of the year, you can actually run the power plant harder. And that's probably what that reflects. But yeah, nuclear power plants, now they can vary their output. Some can and some can't. I ought to be more honest here. Some nuclear power plants are dedicated baseload units that cannot vary their output meaningfully. Most units can, but they don't. Why do they not bother? Well, the answer simply is that their very, very low variable cost of generation means that you don't save much money by cutting back to 50% output. The cost of a kilowatt hour from a nuclear station is pretty low. So the more kilowatt hours you can sell, the better off you are. And again, we're talking about 9 Mile Point and Genet 1, right? 9 Mile Point 1 and Genet, which are more than 50 years old. They're completely paid off, right? The mortgage for those was paid off in 20 years. So every kilowatt hour that they generate is essentially pure profit.
Right.
Interesting.
Now, that's the power of nuclear. We're still paying off those solar panels.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing. People talk, you know, people laugh. They say, oh, yeah, they promised us nuclear energy too cheap to meter back in the 50s. Well, ignoring the fact that was a speech by Admiral Louis Strauss, head of the Atomic Energy Commission, talking about fusion. The fact is, nuclear energy too cheap to meter is a reality. The point is, too cheap to meter doesn't mean too cheap to charge for. It just means that the cost of a kilowatt hour, the incremental cost of a kilowatt hour, is meaningless. And so you just it would be more economical to charge people a fixed fee than to bother and find out how much they used. And how do you know when this is happening? Well, I can tell you it's happening in Ontario. Why do I know it's happening in Ontario? In Ontario, they set the electricity rates quarterly. Well, if you look at Ontario electricity rates, it turns out the rates are highest in the spring and fall and lowest in the summer and winter. In other words, they're inversely proportional to the number of kilowatt hours taken out of the system. Power loads are lower in the spring and the fall because it's temperate, higher in the summer because of air conditioning, higher in the winter because of heating. Well, the implication here is if power is if power costs are essentially flat, right, no matter how many kilowatt hours you draw from the system, it still costs you the same, then why would you even bother charging people by the kilowatt hour?
Because it's profitable, extremely profitable.
You know, just figure out, okay, you've got a 100 amp meter, we're going to charge you X amount. Now, for industrial customers, maybe it's a different story, but for domestic customers, but that, in some ways, when you look at smart meters, the whole point of smart meters is to eliminate the cost of sending some guy around to read the meter. If they had to pay somebody to go around and read the meter, it might not be worth it. They might just send you a fixed bill every quarter.
I would also like to interject, that's exactly what the company does to me. I have an old school meter that's not smart. It is very dumb. And I have to go out and every so often take a picture of it and send it in so that literally, literally Central Hudson doesn't spend the entire year guessing at my usage.
Oh, yeah. They do that for like the whole year. Then you got to send them a picture.
Speculative.
Do you tie the thing to the leg of a pigeon when you send it? Or?
Yes, I have to carry your pigeon the photograph. I'm sorry, the mimeograph over to them.
Oh, Jesus.
Shapirograph. No, I've got a friend in Nevada who specifically pays an extra fee not to have a smart meter because at least the ones in Nevada, some of them caught fire.
Okay.
What kind of batteries they putting in there? Lithium?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I
didn't know Samsung made meters.
They're talking about putting,
dumb mechanical.
Even smarter water meters here in Catskill because the batteries ran out on some of them and the water department charged thousands to the people whose meters ran out.
Okay, so they've got water meters powered by batteries, not by say a little turbine in the water pipe that runs in the water.
That is,
I don't know, Chris, you're thinking, stop it, it's dangerous.
Well, that,
of course, you know, the other one is smart
costs.
Gas meters. Do you really want a big package of electronics connected to your gas meter? Is that really a good idea?
I like rolling the dice.
The insurance doesn't care, so we consider it gambling.
So all these reactors that you've been talking about, are they would they be considered once through sort of uranium-based fuel?
So that is the current situation.
And, yeah.
You know, that is the current situation.
Do you find that kind of wasteful?
Are we talking thorium reactors here?
No, not thorium. Okay. I'm just bringing up the idea that we put the fuel through once and then, you know, then we're done with it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. This is purely a legal situation. You may not know this. The United States used to reprocess fuel from civil nuclear power reactors. In other words, take the fuel, separate out the reusable uranium, the reusable plutonium, and the fission products, which is the actual waste. Your typical, from the kind of nuclear power plants we have in the United States, typically, you know, your discharge fuel composition is 95% reusable uranium, 4% fission products, and 1% plutonium.
Yep.
Now, in West Valley, New York, south of Buffalo, there used to be a nuclear fuel reprocessing plant with a capacity of about 400 tons a year, which is not particularly large. But it existed in the late 60s and early 70s. They shut down to expand the plant and then were never able to reopen it. Firstly, because of additional charges, regulators decided that they needed additional reinforcement against seismic loads. Now, I don't exactly, if you're familiar with the geology of the Great Lakes region, you know, the United States Geological Survey says that the likelihood of an earthquake of above magnitude 5.5 is essentially zero. So that's a bit weird that they'd be required to have special earthquake reinforcement against an earthquake that's never going to happen.
No. Don't say that. They can happen.
300 to 7,000 years, but yeah, it is a black swan.
No, not even on a scale like that. There, earthquakes in this region are possible. And it's, you know, they didn't guard against the cold in Texas, and look what happened to their windmills. So,
wasn't the cold. That was the 5G they injected in it.
That was the liberal conspiracy. The damn hippies were climbing the towers.
I've actually been through a magnitude roughly 5.5 earthquake, oddly enough, here where I live in Fort Worth. Now, it's not, the epicenter was not here. The epicenter was up in Oklahoma. But as far as how far it reached. It was actually really far reaching. Now, that was an interesting case. People talk about fracking and they talk about earthquakes. As it turns out, it's not the fracking that gets you, it's the disposal wells,
yeah,
where they pump down this, you know, used water and brine that came out of the wells. Some idiot up in Oklahoma did not read the geological survey maps properly and started pumping this water into an old meteor crater.
Wow.
As it turns out, the strata underneath meteor craters are heavily fractured, and there was a big shift, and so it produced a low-magnitude earthquake, but one that was felt for hundreds of kilometers. So here, I mean, I noticed the house shifted. I thought there was had been a gust of wind. You know, the big wind comes along, I hear the house shift. If that was like that, and then I noticed that I had a pocket knife hanging from a magnet, and it was just rocking back and forth gently. I said, huh, that was an earthquake! This area is not known for seismicity.
Oklahoma is now in earthquake zone thanks to lots of pumping into the ground, right?
Yeah. Anyway, but you know, this is one of those things.
I'm moving along.
Back to the reprocessing facility that never got reopened.
Yeah. So that was the one and only commercial nuclear fuel reprocessing facility that ever operated in the United States. In Barnwell, South Carolina, a facility with a capacity of 2,000 tons a year was built in the late 70s. It's never been allowed to open. First, there was a moratorium, and then basically the investors who owned the plant said, we don't know if we're going to be allowed to operate it. It doesn't make sense to start it up. Anyway, but to give you an idea of where we're at currently, in the United States, there's roughly 80,000 tons of discharged nuclear fuel, mostly sitting at the sites of the power stations it was discharged from, either in cooling ponds or in dry casks. Now you may say 80,000 tons. Boy, that sounds like a lot. So a typical large coal-fired power station, the Cumberland Fossil Plant of the Tennessee Valley Authority, for example, burns 20,000 tons of coal a day.
Mm. Yep.
So 80,000 tons is actually not that huge an amount. Now, if we had a 2,000 ton per year fuel reprocessing facility, like the one that was built at Barnwell, or like the one the French have at Cap La Hague, which I've been near. I actually took the ferry from Dublin to Cherbourg a couple of years ago, and it actually goes right by there. We could reprocess all the current spent fuel in 40 years. Now, why is that important? Well, again, I said composition is roughly 95% reusable uranium, so 75,000 tons of uranium of roughly 1% uranium-235 content. You can't efficiently use that. You can use that in the kind of power reactors we now have, but not efficiently. To use it efficiently, you'd want to use, for example, Canadian-style heavy water reactors. I don't know. Am I coming through at all?
You are. Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Okay.
Just like,
sorry. I'm just the dogs barking in the entryway is just driving me nuts.
We can
here.
Hear it, but we can. But it's pretty low compared to you.
Okay. Okay. Good. The mic is supposed to be directional, but I'm never sure how directional it truly is.
It's doing good.
It's doing its part.
Yeah.
Okay. So, 76,000 tons of reusable uranium, 800 tons, let's say, of plutonium, of which 500 tons is plutonium-239, the fissile isotope. The remaining 300 is plutonium-240. Okay, so what does that actually give us? Well, for example, and, you know, yeah, the French are in the position where they would need to re-enrich their recycled uranium in order to use it in nuclear power plants that they already have or ones they might be building. Because there's a rumor that President Macron is going to announce 6 new 1,500 megawatt nuclear power units before Christmas. Now, why would he announce that? Well, you may have noticed the price of natural gas is kind of high.
Yeah, in Europe. Yes.
And the Germans are supposed to shut down half of their remaining 7 gigawatts of nuclear on December 31st.
Yeah, and they've already decommissioned so many of them.
Yeah, where are they going to get replacement power? The Belgians? So Belgium actually got to 50% nuclear power before France did, but a series of hostile governments have made it impossible for the Belgian electric utilities to invest in replacing those plants. So if they're taken out of service next year, which is the plan, basically 40, the biggest single chunk of Belgium's electrical generating capacity just goes bye-bye. And there's no plan, right, for replacing that.
What, everybody can't jump on a bicycle and start generating their own juice?
And that's the COP26's plan, right? Everybody has to start biking.
Yeah, that's where we're at, right? Conference 26 conference of parties to the Rio de Janeiro Climate Accords. And after 26 conferences, what has actually been accomplished? I mean,
they're shutting
for example,
down the cleanest source of energy that, I mean, Europe is the poster boy, or was, before
and
they started shutting them all down.
And private jets flew to that conference.
Not to the state, private yachts, mega yachts and all that. Yeah.
You know, in quantitative terms, right, according to official figures, German emissions have not decreased at all since 1998. I've had people tell me to my face, oh, you know, Germany's 100% solar now. Mm-hmm. Somebody actually said that to me. German emissions have not fallen at all since 1998, and that's by official figures, which are probably somewhat optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, there's 26 conferences of parties to the Rio de Janeiro Accords, and
the Germans are precise.
You know. And again, you know, you want to look at Germany and France, right? You can look at, for example, the IEA's key world statistic, International Energy Agency, which is different from the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's also different from, it's a unit of the OECD. It's different from the OECD Nuclear Energy Agency. It's also different from the United States Energy Information Agency. All these things have very similar names, and you can get really fouled up on them. But if you look at IEA key world statistics, Germany and France have about the same population. They have very similar economies in terms of GDP, industrialization, all that kind of thing. German emissions are twice those of France per head of population, per euro of GDP, or roughly in total, because again, their country is about the same size. And the only difference, really, the only difference in the two economies is where they get their electricity.
And France is more heavily nuclear?
France is about 75 to 80% nuclear. The remainder is hydro.
Nice.
They have essentially no fossil fuel electric generation. There's a couple of fossil fuel burning plants in the country which are brought online a week or two in the typical year for when the loads get really high.
It's good to have
and
a
Germany
backup.
Germany has a certain amount of its baseload provided by fossils.
Germany has quite a lot of lignite. This is the odd thing. They've shut down their hard coal burning power stations, but they're still burning lignite, which is a dirtier fuel.
But is it like cheaper, more accessible?
The main difference is that lignite is typically strip mined, whereas hard coal is typically mined underground. Although that's by no means universally true, it is typically true. Near me, as a matter of fact, there is what's called Big Brown, which is one of the larger mine-mouth power plants in the country. In other words, there's a lignite strip mine right there in the middle of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, and a big lignite-burning power plant right there on the site. Well, it was claimed that they were going to, for environmental purposes, they were going to stop burning the lignite, which is mined right there, and start burning bituminous coal brought from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming by train.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Every day here where I live, right, every day, there's roughly 110 car string of coal cars, each of which carries 100 to 110 tons of coal, headed south to San Antonio for their coal-burning power plants. And of course, the same string heads back empty the next day. And so between here and the Powder River Basin, there are, at any given time, between, I guess, 10 and 20 unit coal trains in motion. And that's just for the one set of power plants near San Antonio. But, you know, that's a thing, right? That
clean coal.
I was in Buffalo, New York in the middle of the night a few years ago, which is not something I would recommend to anybody, but, you know, that's how life is sometimes. I was in Buffalo in the middle of the night at the train station there.
Was it winter? Because the way it gets worse.
I was sitting there, and down the line comes a unit oil train, 100 or 120 oil tank cars, probably moving. You know, it could have been Canadian crude oil. It could have been crude oil from North Dakota.
Yep.
But you know, that's the thing, is that you gotta keep the lights on. You gotta keep people warm, right? And if you don't want, you know, New York doesn't want fracking in upstate New York. Okay, I buy that. New York doesn't want pipelines through upstate New York. Okay, I buy that. Well, how are you gonna keep the lights on? How are you gonna keep people warm in the winter? Are you burning heating oil? Is that heating oil coming by train from Alberta, half on the other side of the continent?
We could do a lot of shipping with
by
the Hudson.
Up the Hudson. Yeah, is it?
Most of ours comes in by boat. Greatly.
Even the trains down here.
Yeah, that's
watch the
bomb
oil
trains.
Cars whip yeah. right past.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and again, you know, this is a thing, you know, that just boggles my mind that, you know, Andrew Cuomo is gone, but before he left, he managed to succeed in fulfilling a long-term promise, which is to kill the Indian Point nuclear station, Buchanan, New York, you know, up the Hudson from New York City. Now, where does that leave New York City getting its power? Well, one answer is Ravenswood. Ravenswood is kind of interesting. That I think they burn oil brought in from Venezuela. Not 100% sure on that. Somebody should look into that. But
they're talking about
oil.
They're talking about making projects up here where they pump water into a reservoir in the mountains near the Astrakhan, which is where they get a lot of their drinking water, and then
the Astrakhan.
Sure, man.
Okay.
The Astrakhan. And then letting it go down to provide hydroelectric during peak hours.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a power supply to pump with, that's the thing, is that because nuclear power stations run best at a continuous heavy load, when Indian Point 2 was built, Con Edison wanted to install a pump storage facility like that, and the environmentalists screamed to high heaven that it was going to destroy the fish habitat in the Hudson River. So apparently this is no longer true if the electricity is coming from somewhere other than a nuclear plant. I regard that as mysterious logic.
Well, nuclear power plants do have to draw a lot of water for cooling.
Isn't the Hudson already somewhat poisoned by all the PCBs from GE over decades of manufacture?
Yeah, but a nuclear power plant isn't going to do nearly the same kind of... They won't do any kind of damage like that.
Yeah, well, basically the one thing... There's two things that a nuclear power plant might do that you wouldn't necessarily like. One thing is it takes in a lot of water, heats it slightly, and discharges it again. Now, some places they put in cooling towers so that it draws a much smaller amount of water from the nearby body of water. But if you're on a seacoast or a very large river, you know, a cooling tower is usually sort of an extra expense you don't necessarily need. The second possibility is, if you're drawing in large volumes of water, you could wind up chewing up and killing, you know, small fish. Again, this has not typically been a problem. To give you a great example from my own personal experience, I happened to be in Finland in 2017. The World Science Fiction Convention was in Helsinki, and I convinced the organizers to get us a tour of a nuclear power plant. Now, the nuclear power plant near Helsinki, Loviisa, was not available that week. And so we had to cross the entire country to the Gulf of Bothnia, to Olkiluoto. Crossing Finland is more or less like crossing, I don't know, Michigan or something. It's not a huge way, but it did mean we had had to get on a bus first thing in the morning and go a couple of hours across the country.
Were on quite a journey there, just like our listeners are on an audio journey listening to 90.7 FM, Acre, Hudson, Catskill.
Good. Skill, Joe.
FCC.
Back to your great journey segue. Through science.
But yeah, so as it turns out, at Olkiluoto, we were told that there is a long waiting list for fishing permits. Because the thing is, there's a protected area where you're not allowed, near the discharge of the power plant, where for security reasons, you're not allowed to go without a permit. Well, the fishing there is really great, as it turns out. And so there's a long waiting list for that.
And none of these fish are coming out with three eyes or anything?
No. Apparently, if they are, they're three delicious eyes.
All right.
the seal population is also booming in the area.
All the
which
fish.
Tells you that things good things are going on. Same is true, San Onofre. San Onofre, for real Californians, which has been shut down now, alas, they used to have to warn off fishing boats from getting too close because the fishing was that good. So, clearly, you know, the negative and positive effects seem to more or less balance each other out, I guess, is the most fair judgment that can be made. And again, this is partly just due to the fact that when a nuclear power plant is put in, there are very strict requirements for studying its environmental impact on the surrounding area. And so they have laboratories that, you know, catch fish and survey them to find out if they've got radioactive substances in them and all kinds of other things, which are meant to make sure, long before anything important could happen, whether or not there is an effect on people or wildlife or agriculture or any of those other things that are so important to our lives.
A few years down the road, everybody starts walking funny. They start hearing things, each other's thoughts.
So there's a lot in here to unpack. I have a question about what you might think about Gen 4 reactors and how they address the waste problem, which is that, you know, you mentioned that they're keeping a lot of this fuel in need of reprocessing on site, and it has to be stored for, you know, a 100 generations. But a lot of the Gen 4 reactor designs are aimed specifically at addressing that problem.
Yeah, well,
what do you think about
sort of
them?
So the whole Generation 4 concept is kind of an odd moniker because, of right. course, you know, one of the key Generation 4 so-called reactors is the sodium-cooled fast breeder reactor.
Which you mentioned they were building in the 1970s. They had them.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, the first electricity, a meaningful electricity ever generated from a nuclear reactor, December 20th, 1951, was from Experimental Breeder Reactor Number 1 out at Idaho Falls. The World Science Fiction Convention is in the winter this year. They actually closes on December 19th, and I'm trying to get the organizers to let me have a space to do an exhibit about nuclear energy just because of the coincidence in time. But yeah, December 20th of this year is the 70th anniversary of the first meaningful generation of electricity, I mean more than a toy scale, literally toy scale, from a nuclear reactor. And that was from a liquid metal cooled fast breeder reactor. Again, another one of the Generation 4 so-called concepts, the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. Helium-cooled, graphite-moderated, uses typically using some degree of thorium fueling. Well,
makes
Fort St. Vrain. Fort St. Vrain was a utility-scale, high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. It was built in the United States in the 1970s. Unfortunately, it was not a technical success. It had nothing to do with the reactor design at all, as it turns out. It was simply due to the fact the gas circulators, the blowers that move the helium gas around in the reactor, were driven by steam turbines. This seemed like a great idea because it meant that if the power went out of the reactor, you could still drive the cooling blowers, right? Good idea. One little problem. The systems that they built to keep the steam from leaking into the reactor were not as effective as they should have been. And so they spent a lot of time shut down.
It poisoned the reaction. It poisoned that reaction.
Well, the main thing just is that steam is corrosive.
Right.
And so there was a lot of problem with corrosion that they had to keep shutting down and to repair something. So it was never an economical reactor. But that problem is solved as now, essentially, because in large-scale natural gas pumping plants, for example, the blowers use magnetic bearings. Magnetic bearings don't require oil lubrication. They don't require water lubrication. You can use an electric motor and a magnetic bearing, and the fact is, in the gas-cooled reactor, the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor using what's called TRISO fuel, cooling circulation isn't required for safety. Because there's no possibility of what you call a fuel meltdown or anything like that. The fuel is actually in the form of tiny ceramic granules which are encased in silicon carbide and graphite. And the result is that even in the worst possible accident, the damage to the fuel is very, very small, and the migration of fission products out of the fuel is very, very small. And so there's no possibility of radioactive releases that would harm the public.
Just big, basically radioactive ball pit.
And the helium isn't that's not at temperature, is it? It's not at a super high temperature or pressure, is it?
Well, the helium When the reactor is operating, the helium is at a pressure of several tens of atmospheres, much less than the 100 atmospheres typical of the water in a water reactor, but still several tens of atmospheres, and a temperature which can be up to 900 or 1,000 degrees centigrade. This is one of the advantages of the high-temperature reactor, is you don't just use it for generating power. Now, if you use it for generating power, you take the helium out at about 750 degrees centigrade, you produce steam at about 550 degrees centigrade. This allows you to use modern steam equipment, which is not only more efficient, but also less expensive than the stuff you have to use in water reactors, which uses lower temperature steam. But the real key is, from the high temperature gas-cooled reactor, you can get that heat out at 800, 900, 1,000 degrees centigrade, possibly, which means you can do things like steel making, which means you can do coal gasification was a process that was extensively studied in the 1970s.
You can cook a whole lot of chicken.
Yes. World's largest chicken fryer powered by nuclear energy.
Instantly fries 10,000 tons of chicken.
Atomic fried chicken. That is, there you go. You can have that one for
trademark.
Free.
Trademark.
Popcorn popper.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We build one of these in central Nebraska and just pop the entire world's supply of popcorn every year.
Pop the whole state.
The whole state.
Hey, what else is
corn husker?
Oh man.
Oh. Yeah, so that's
so
a good
question. Who's ahead on like current advanced nuclear energy research right now? I know the U.S. is kind of behind on the curve, right? And China, other countries,
yeah, we're just
are,
waiting for our own
and India
Fukushima
are
now.
Actually doing research on, you know, new generation technologies that use that get rid of our current waste and turn it in and take years away from its poison, right? Take away the
health. So, yeah, I mean, the thing to remember is, you know, again, as I say, the constituents of your spent nuclear fuel, you've got uranium, plutonium, and fission products. Now, fission products come in two groups. One has half-lives that are all shorter than 30 years. That's where the energy is. Cesium-137, strontium-90 are the main constituents there after it's cooled for 3 or 4 years. The other is... And so all that energy is gone within 300 years, right? 300 years is 10 half-lives of the longest live constituents, which means that after 300 years, you don't have to worry about it. There's also a group of fission products which has 100,000 year and longer half-lives, but those have very low energy. So they're not really a concern. As a matter of fact, iodine-129 is one of the best known of these. If all the iodine in your body were iodine-129, it would still be less than the allowable body burden, so it's not really something to worry about. not that I'm recommending this, right, but, you
I
know.
Don't know about that, since it accumulates in the thyroid, and that could break down your thyroid pretty badly.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Iodine-131...
That point aside...
Yeah, iodine-131, with a half-life of 9 days, 8 days, is dangerous to your thyroid. It's got a lot of energy, and it delivers it rapidly. Iodine-129, with a half-life in the hundreds of thousands of years, you know, you would wait a long time for a single decay.
It's like getting a dental X-ray.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I'm getting off the point here. The point is that people say, oh, you got to keep this stuff safe for a quarter of a million years or whatever. Well, they're talking about plutonium. The only sensible thing to do with plutonium is to shove it into a power reactor and use it up. The United States has 34 tons of surplus weapons plutonium. We have an agreement with the Russians to fabricate that into reactor fuel and put it into a reactor and use it up. We made that agreement over 20 years ago, and we still haven't done it. We spent billions of dollars trying to come up with a so-called alternative disposition scheme that the agreement we have with the Russians doesn't actually allow us to do. Why? Because the political climate in the United States, there's a political rule that you don't use plutonium for civil power reactor fuel. Why? It doesn't even make any sense, okay? But that's the thing. I mean, saw a thing recently that said, you know, climate, you know, carbon dioxide emissions are being undercounted. And they start off by saying, this Al Gore-backed study. And I said, well, I wouldn't trust Albert Gore Jr. further than I can throw him, because he talks a lot about climate, but he has never expressed a single word of regret over killing the IFR program. IFR, the Integral Fast Reactor, is the most advanced nuclear power plant concept in the world, quite possibly. And the United States was the world leader with this concept. See, IFR was a fast reactor, right? Fast breeder reactor with a high breeding ratio, meaning that when you build a plant, the time that it takes to produce enough surplus plutonium to build a second plant of the same kind is shorter, which if you want to replace fossil fuels, you want to build these things as rapidly as possible, right? So the high breeding ratio is a benefit. Now, IFR had the interesting characteristic, it used metallic fuel, which was reprocessed on site. In other words, you make an initial load of fuel for it, take that to the reactor site, and then the actual fuel recycling was all done at the reactor site. Now, this isn't some kind of hypothetical approach. This was actually done. EBR-2, Experimental Breeder Reactor Number 2 at ARCO, Idaho, actually operated in this mode for years, taking the fuel out of the core, reprocessing it in an attached facility, putting it back into the core. Now, this is the IFR concept, to scale this up to a practical power plant level and hopefully bring the costs reasonably down. The U.S. was the world leader in this, and then we said, we're not going to do this anymore. China is talking about building high-temperature gas-cooled reactors specifically to replace coal-fired boilers at existing power plants, because they would produce steam at the same steam conditions that the coal-fired boilers do, modern coal-fired boilers. That would be a major step forward, right? You can't
move from coal to nuclear.
Yeah. Now,
they're a major consumer of coal.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
They burn the most, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. China is a huge user of coal, huge producer, and yet they use so much they have to import it.
Well, actually, they burn more coal than the rest of the world combined.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. So, North China, right. North China is one of the world's richest coal-producing provinces, and yet they burn so much coal they also have to import it from Australia. And I mean, even North Korea sells coal to China.
Most of Australia's grid is coal.
Yeah, Australia is very coal heavy. Yep. Australia is one of the world's largest exporters of uranium, but it is illegal to have a nuclear power plant in Australia.
What? Just flat out, they don't have any nuclear.
Yeah, there is a law against it. There is one reactor in the whole country. It's a research reactor, doesn't generate power. It does produce much of the supply of medical isotopes used in the Southern Hemisphere. It also produces a lot of high-quality N-type silicon, because it turns out that for high-power switching devices, triacs and thyristors, SCRs, those kinds of things, particularly the kind that are used for grid tie inverters for solar and wind installations, those are actually made in nuclear reactors.
No way.
Yeah. See, the thing is, the traditional method for making N-type semiconductor silicon is to take high-purity silicon wafers and put them into a furnace and diffuse them with phosphine gas, and that embeds phosphorus atoms in the wafer, and that gives you an excess of charge carriers. Super it's what's safe. Called N-type silicon. If you ever look at transistors in a catalog or anything, most of them are what's called NPN rather than PNP, and it just has to do with the fact that N-type silicon is easier to manufacture and get high quality. But here's the thing. N-type silicon made by diffusion is uneven. The phosphorus density in the silicon varies. So there'll be clumps with a high gain and clumps with a low gain. And for small signal transistors, this isn't much of a problem. But for big, high-power switching devices, it can mean that two, what are supposed to be identical devices, one of them dissipates twice as much power as the other, which is bad. That can lead to your system blowing up, literally. Normally it doesn't, because good designers take other measures to make sure that doesn't happen, but it does happen from time to time. Anyway, so how do you get high-quality, uniform semiconductor silicon? Answer is, you take that high-purity silicon boule, as it's called, big ingot, and instead of slicing it and diffusing it, you stick it in a nuclear reactor. What happens then? Well, a small proportion of the silicon atoms will absorb a neutron. They become a radioactive, short-lived isotope of silicon, which decays almost immediately to phosphorus. And then you produce N-type silicon, where the phosphorus is very, very uniformly distributed through the whole of the material, which means you have high-quality material, which you can then slice up and make into high-power switching devices. Now, if there were a bigger supply of this, everybody would be using it. right? But as it is, your grid tie inverters for your solar installation on your rooftop, grid tie inverters for a wind machine, the power controllers in your electric car, all of these things use silicon, which is made in nuclear reactors.
Everything that's brought the cost of that down to the point where a consumer can afford something like those tie-ins, those inverters.
You need it to make, you have to have that much product in the first place. So the more nuclear reactors we have, the more we might be able to accelerate our technology.
I mean, you know, that's the thing, is that, yeah, if we had larger supplies of this stuff, again, not made in power reactors, it's made in another kind of reactor entirely, research reactors that could potentially be made in the Canadian-style power reactors, but in practice, it's currently not being done. But it is being made in research reactors. I visited one, actually, at the beginning of October, just a month ago, first Sunday in October, at Garching, north of Munich. Really great. I actually got a personal guided tour of the facility. I will say, they refer to it always as a neutron source. They don't call it a nuclear reactor. They ask you, please don't say that. This is Germany. People will tar and feather us.
We have rebranded it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the only thing in the whole name, it's known as the Heinz-Meyer-Leibniz-Forschungsneutronenquelle, the Heinz-Meyer-Leibniz Research Neutron Source. And then in small brackets, it says FRM2, where FRM stands for Forschungsreaktor Munich. In other words, Research Reactor Munich. So it's, anyway, but that's just hilarious to me, is that I the guy actually said, just don't talk about it as a nuclear reactor, please. But yeah, so yeah, Australia has a law against nuclear power plants. Now, the funny thing is, Australia actually started building. Australia, a major exporter of uranium, right? Why don't they produce nuclear power the way Canada does? Well, in the early 1970s, they actually started a nuclear power program, and then it was abandoned almost immediately for the dumbest reason. I'm going to give you a dumb story about Australia. In the late 60s, early 70s, Australia, the Australian government, had this bee in its bonnet at the highest levels. The Prime Minister and his closest circle of advisors, they thought they needed nuclear weapons. They thought they needed an independent thermonuclear deterrent force, independent of their close allies, the U.S. and Great Britain. So they said, well, what we're going to do is, we're going to order a nuclear power plant, and then we're going to use plutonium from the nuclear power plant to make our own atom bombs, right?
Yeah.
This is the scenario that everybody tells you, oh, no, nuclear power plants could, you know, lead to nuclear weapons. Well, what actually happened was, they set up a scientific and technical committee to choose the best nuclear reactor for Australia. And they picked the British steam-generating heavy water reactor, which is irrelevant, except they started construction on it, and then somebody pointed out to the Prime Minister that this would not be suitable for making nuclear weapons. Because the thing was, they had not told the technical committee that that was the objective.
Oh,
and
my
so the technical committee,
no, they'll drop it.
And so the technical committee selected a reactor design which would be completely unsuitable for this purpose.
That doesn't breed and plutonium.
Well, the thing is, it does produce plutonium, but so here's the key. So there's very few. If you want to make plutonium for bombs, you have to leave the uranium in the reactor a quite short time, and you have to reprocess large volumes of uranium. And so your typical production reactor, in other words, the reactor that's used for producing military plutonium, it uses slugs of uranium metal as fuel in fairly simple metal jackets. Because you're fabricating huge numbers of these slugs, you're feeding them in one at a time, and then you're taking them out and dissolving them in acid.
It sounds like a really fun bullet.
You don't want to deal with processing ceramides like silicon carbide and graphite.
Exactly. You don't wanna deal with that. So the thing is, you know, so there's only really one family of power reactors that ever used fuel like that. That was the British Magnox reactors, which are derived from the Calder Hall and Chapel Cross plutonium production reactors. Fun thing about Calder Hall and Chapel Cross is that almost from the beginning, they were run more as power stations than as plutonium producers. The fuel charges were left in the reactor so long that, firstly, much of the plutonium that was produced was then consumed in the reactor. And secondly, much of what was left was converted to plutonium-240, which is bad for bomb making. It's something you want to avoid. Anyway, but those, again, those are simple metallic slugs. Now, for a reactor that uses a ceramic fuel, such as uranium oxide, very popular fuel. You know, the cost of fabricating it, the cost of reprocessing it is considerably higher. It's also really, really obvious, right? Because the thing is, if you had, say, a CANDU reactor, in principle, you could use a CANDU reactor to make weapons plutonium, but you'd have to feed the fuel in 10 times as rapidly as you do for power reactor operation. So if you're building a fuel production plant and it's 10 times as large, that's really obvious.
Yeah. So it's one or the other, not, yeah.
It's a cookie factory.
Yeah. I mean, to give you an idea, when the first Magnox stations were being built, to be clear, these were derived directly from military plutonium-producing reactors. Nevertheless, the defense ministry in Britain said, "Oh, we're going to have to fit these so they can produce weapons-grade plutonium." And the Central Electricity Generating Board screamed to high heaven. They said, "That will ruin the economics of our beautiful new power plants." So the Australian nuclear power experience is bizarre, and it's even getting more bizarre now with this insane announcement that the United States and Britain are going to supply Australia with nuclear-powered submarines. Firstly, it's still illegal. It's still illegal. Secondly...
Is it, though? Is it illegal to have them in Australian waters?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you're not allowed to have a nuclear power plant in Australia. Presumably, this applies to the government.
And each submarine is a significant power plant.
Does the law ever supply to the government?
But then there's the additional thing. So the Australians, when they negotiated the deal to buy submarines from France in the first place, it was explicitly stated that the French could provide nuclear submarines if the Australians changed their mind. So that part doesn't make any sense. The part that really doesn't make any sense is this. U.S. naval reactors and British naval reactors, which are based on the U.S. design, use bomb-grade uranium, of which the U.S. doesn't have very much at all, because we shut down the plants that made that stuff decades ago. We don't have enough for the naval program we already have, so where is it going to come from to supply the British?
A supply chain for the fuel. For those submarines. Like, it's all
we
gone.
Do not.
They'll have to source it from, I don't know, North Korea or something.
Well, that means we've got to build a new reactor for that.
There you go.
Yeah,
a new reactor design for the ships.
Yeah,
or just
the
make
French,
sure we have, you know, people that can supply us.
The French naval reactors use much lower enrichments. They have a plant that makes the fuel for French naval reactors. So where this whole Australia deal makes no sense whatsoever to me. That's just, I'm just laying it out there. But yeah, if I were specifying a new generation of power reactors in the United States, you know, there'd be two types I would specify. The first would be IFRs. In other words, that fast breeder reactor to get rid of that 34 tons of weapons plutonium we're supposed to get rid of, and also the roughly 800 tons of plutonium we would get from recycling our existing nuclear fuel. Second type of reactor I would specify is the Canadian-style heavy water reactors. Why? Because they get twice as much energy out of the recycled uranium as if we re-enrich that and put that into light water reactors. And, you know, between those two, and also re-enriching some of our depleted uranium, we could easily add another 100 gigawatts. You know, we have roughly 100 gigawatts of nuclear electric generating capacity in this country right now. We could easily add another 100 in the coming 10, 15 years without mining a single ton of uranium.
Just using the old waste.
Yeah, just using the existing stocks of spent fuel that are already above ground and the existing stocks of depleted uranium.
And also now, taking the fangs out of that waste while we're doing it. Right?
Right. That's the thing, is that we separate the spent nuclear fuel into the long-lived hazardous actinides, uranium, plutonium, and the short-lived, less dangerous fission products. Hey, we put the actinides into a reactor and use them up. Now, thing is another 100 gigawatts of nuclear gonna cut it? No, okay? People talk about electrifying transportation. If you actually had 100 million electric cars in this country...
Yeah. 100 million chargers... a ton more use of the entire electrical grid. Yep. A lot of people looking for all the batteries that they've been killing and trying to swap out. Eventually, their cars stop working. They start slaughtering each other for their batteries.
Even more animation.
I need more power.
It seems like Joe has stuff that's through.
And then you see the guys driving along with the diesel generators on the little trailer behind them.
Yeah. Yeah, like Leo, exactly. You know, I was in the Verkehrszentrum, the Deutsches Museum, the Transportation Museum in Munich. They have one of these cars from the Second World War period that had a charcoal-burning oven on a little trailer behind it to provide producer gas to burn in the car's engine.
Yes!
Yeah.
Nice. Oh, I love looking at the wood gas-powered cars on the internet.
We are starting to run out of time, so is there any sort of message you want to get out there before we wrap up?
I think that last one was a pretty strong one.
That was pretty strong. IFRs and... what did you say?
Heavy water reactors. Canadian style heavy water reactors.
Get rid of our waste by using it.
How do we make people happy to put them in their own backyard? Like, they don't start picketing with, you know, words like Fukushima and Chernobyl on their placards.
Yeah, you have two.
You
minutes.
Know, two it's minutes. Hard because people have this doomsday mentality, but it only applies to nuclear. It's weird. They're willing to have natural gas lines running to their house. Mm-hmm. People are killed by natural gas explosions every year. Yeah, it's never happened in a civil power plant in the United States.
It blew up in Massachusetts a couple years ago.
A few whole neighborhoods got blown sky high just because, like, one guy turned on a valve too fast.
That's right. But yeah, and in Dallas, Texas, at the beginning of last year, there was a 12-year-old honor student blown up by a gas explosion. And again, nobody has ever been killed by a nuclear reactor accident in a civil power station in the United States. But
that's a lot of qualifiers. Yes.
Calm down.
Anyway, let's see. I got a website: man-and-atom.info. Anybody wants to send me some mail, including mail with a check in it, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101. And people who want to send me PayPal, paypal.me/PrometheusLives. Anyway, and I will be happy to send you. I've got stickers, I've got buttons, I got all kinds of neat stuff I'd be happy to give anybody who wants it.
Yeah, he sent some cool stickers from the power plant in Germany that I talked about.
Give it a check, give it a look, people. This man's worth it.
Swag.
We have 1 minute.
1 minute, probably less than that. You've been listening to the Thingularity radio program, and if you would like to keep listening to us, we might just keep on going into an after show. Who knows?
Maybe.
But you got to go to WGXE.org and catch our stream that's playing under the listen section, and otherwise, we're going to be getting out of here right quick.
Yeah.
Our guest tonight has been Christopher Carson. Thanks, man, for showing up. This has been great. Super helpful.
Yeah.
Anybody got anything they want to say to the world out there before we leave? No happy Halloween, no, like, it's winter, or snow, bring on the snow. Bring on the snow!
Snow Christmas, get this year over with, for God's sake.
I think it's first week of December.
Yeah, we're out by now.
Neat. So we could probably cut the ship noises.
Hey, that was great, man.
Yeah.
So, you're not interested at all in the molten salt reactors at all?
Oh, this molten salt is really cool, okay? I have nothing to say against it,
okay.
But the people who are promoting it as a near-term solution, I think, are being a little unrealistic. Let me lay out
China
for you a
didn't
plan.
Think so. I mean, they made one in, like, central China, didn't they? They have one in central China province.
Let me lay out for you a plan about molten salt, just to give you an idea. See, the thing is, okay.
Does it go on my pretzel?
Yes.
It could. Pretzel would be very burnt.
Yes. There's two technologies. Right. There's two technologies for molten salt reactor. The first is just using molten uranium fluorides, typically, in a reactor. Now, that's been demonstrated. Okay, back in the 1960s at Oak Ridge, they had molten salt reactor experiment.
Yep.
And they showed that you could have a reactor which generated useful amounts of heat and was reasonably stable. That's the first hurdle to get over, absolutely. Now, when you talk about molten salt reactors, most people are talking about reactors which can also reprocess their own fuel.
Or breed new fuel with the thorium into
uranium-233. Right. So the thing is, if you want to get started on the thorium-uranium-233 cycle...
Yes, sir.
If you want to get started on the thorium-uranium-233 cycle, the first thing that you need is a supply of fissile material. Because, of course, thorium contains no fissile material, so you need either U-233 from somewhere, U-235, from somewhere, or plutonium-239 from somewhere.
Which, as you mentioned, we do have vast reserves of, which we can...
No. When it comes to uranium-233, the United States has probably the world's largest supply, but it's all locked up.
Yeah, it's a huge gamma radiator.
So it's like some Indian Point Unit 1. Indian Point Unit 1 was a nuclear power plant that operated in downstate New York for several years.
Yeah.
Its first reactor, it was a weird reactor because
it used about it all the time in the news, too.
It used a fossil fuel fired superheater. So it was half nuclear, half fossil fuel.
What? No!
Weird design. There were a handful of those built. They were never very popular for fairly obvious reasons. But
have a good night. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
But when it was first built, it was known as the Consolidated Edison Thorium Reactor because its first core used highly enriched uranium-235 and thorium rather than low-enriched uranium. Second core used low-enriched uranium. That became standard from then on. Now, the other... But in the course of its operation, it produced a sizable amount of uranium-233. That fuel was never reprocessed. If you reprocessed it today, you would get a mixture of uranium-235 and uranium-233, which could be useful for starting up molten salt reactors or any other thorium breeder reactor you wanted to come up with. Fort St. Vrain, I mentioned before, also used uranium-235 and thorium. Now, it used in a different way. The thorium was physically separate from the uranium-235, so you could reprocess them separately. That's an advantage in some ways. Third major... But again, that fuel's never been reprocessed. It's just sitting there. Third, shipping port light water breeder reactor. Now, shipping port was the first pressurized water reactor civilian power plant. It was a big, it was a prototype. Actually, the reactor they used was originally built for the Navy, and then that project was canceled. But that's not important. The important thing is it was used experimentally to test new core designs. And the last core design was called the Light Water Breeder Reactor. That was a thorium-uranium-233 core that was designed to be backfitted to any pressurized water reactor. So you could turn pretty much any existing nuclear power plant into a thorium breeder reactor overnight.
Wow.
Well, you know, in 90 days or so.
Yeah.
Thing is, so that core operated for several years. When it was taken out of service, they judged that there was about a 1% gain in uranium-233 content over the fuel cycle of about 3.5 years. Again, that fuel's never been reprocessed. If it were reprocessed today, you know, we would be able to recover that. Now, question, where did the uranium-233 for that come from? As it turns out, it came from the... Yeah,
go ahead.
From the... It came from the weapons production reactors at Hanford. They loaded thorium slugs into the reactor alongside the uranium slugs and made it in the weapons material production reactor alongside weapons-grade plutonium.
All right.
So, where else
made
are there...
Made in USA.
Where else are there what?
So yeah, if you wanted to start a thorium fuel cycle, the easiest way to start it up is actually with Canadian-style heavy water reactors.
Sure.
This is something the Indians have actually demonstrated, because the thing is, Canadian-style reactors use short fuel bundles which are fed in and out of the reactor pretty much continuously. You can just start loading thorium bundles into the reactor. Now, if you do that with a reactor fueled with natural uranium, eventually it'll shut down because the thorium absorbs neutrons and the rate of production of uranium-233 is not great enough to compensate for that.
Right.
But
you gotta actually store that thorium for about 30 days because it turns to protactinium, then it decays into uranium.
Yeah. So, the thing is, when the Indians start up a new heavy water reactor, they, of course, when the fuel is all fresh, it contains more uranium-235 than at equilibrium when it's halfway burned up, right? So that's more reactive, which means you would need to put in the control rods farther or something like that. So instead of that, they load in thorium bundles into the central area of the reactor, central zone, and those act as absorbers. But the fun thing about them is, as the uranium gets burned up and its reactivity goes down, the reactivity of the thorium bundles increases. So it helps to level out the power distribution in the reactor over time. Well, back in the 70s, the Canadians studied this, and they came to the conclusion that if you loaded low-enriched uranium bundles, you could load them alternately with thorium bundles, and you could get about twice as much. So, back up a step. If you use low-enriched uranium instead of natural uranium in a Canadian-style power reactor, you can actually get about twice as much power per unit of initially mined uranium.
Yeah.
The only people in the world who actually do this are in Argentina. In Argentina, they have a heavy water power reactor of a design nobody else uses, and they use uranium, which is slightly enriched, 0.85% uranium-235, as opposed to natural uranium is 0.7%. So the Argentinians in Atucha Unit 1 do use this, and they're getting like 12.5 or 14 megawatt days per kilogram of... Anyway, that's not important. The important thing is they've basically doubled their fuel burn up by increasing the amount of U-235 only slightly.
Yeah.
So, but it's been shown mathematically that you could load, say, 1% enriched uranium from reprocessing light water reactor fuel that we have 80,000 tons of into these heavy water reactors, load that alternately with thorium bundles, and you would at least double the amount of power you got out of a unit of uranium fuel.
In comparison to the low, just low-enriched uranium fuel.
Mm. Yeah, and
which is already doubled, exactly. So we're talking about quadrupling the power output.
Right, so the thing is, you know, we can start with the waste, in other words, the spent fuel, as our starting point. And so we load that just into the reactors as is. We get a certain number, you know, 20 megawatt days per kilogram. Now, we load that in alternately with thorium bundles, and we could increase we could at least double the amount of power we got out. And so that in itself, and at the end of the day, you discharge those thorium bundles and reprocess them, you can recover the uranium-233 from them and use that to start up other reactors that want uranium-233, such as molten salt breeders, such as aqueous breeders, such as you name it.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, molten salt reactors specifically. I am looking for another technology, and that is the use of molten salt in reprocessing. That's the thing, because if you can build a reactor which is using molten salt as fuel and continuously reprocessing it, well, it's obviously much easier to build a reprocessing plant that uses molten salt and doesn't have the reactor attached.
That's one of the technical challenges of the recent designs. Like, if you can have an online sort of reprocessing, like a gaseous bubbler to take the other fission products out of the fuel fluid, that's great. But it's also one of the technological developments that hasn't happened yet.
Right. And so if we're really going to do molten salt reactors, obviously we want to have that kind of on-stream fuel processing. Yeah. And I would say that, you know, it's been considered for a long time that that principle would make it much cheaper to reprocess light water reactor fuel.
For sure.
Much cheaper than the conventional method, which involves dissolving an acid and using a bunch of solvents, and it's very elaborate. That molten salt reprocessing, to give you an idea, you know, uranium hexafluoride is a substance which is very much handled in the nuclear fuel cycle. It's nasty stuff, but you don't have to handle a lot of it. So uranium hexafluoride is a part of the fuel processing cycle in a molten salt reactor on the uranium-thorium cycle.
Right, because that molten salt, it becomes like an ion, and it's floating around in the molten salt as part of your fuel.
Yeah, so uranium concentrations in the molten salt reactor are quite low. You know, only 1 or 2% of the salt in the reactor is uranium salt. There'll be 1 or 2% uranium salt, a few percent thorium salt, and then a lot of it is like lithium or beryllium.
Yep.
And that gets to be a problem, actually, because beryllium is expensive.
I've also seen FLYNAC, which is fluoride, lithium, and sodium, and potassium.
Right.
So there's that as a solution.
There are a variety of different salts which have been proposed and used in experiments. Zirconium and all kinds, zirconium tetrafluoride being an example.
Mm.
But the point basically is, if you can handle this on-stream reprocessing, well, it becomes much easier to build a reprocessing plant to take in light water reactor fuel and separate out the uranium, the plutonium, the fission products. In other words, I would expect that a reprocessing plant like that for handling light water reactor fuel would be the obvious first step before deploying molten salt reactors on a large scale.
Yeah.
Because it's much easier to build a reprocessing plant that is not tightly coupled to a reactor.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
The back in the 1960s, actually, General Electric built a reprocessing plant at Morris, Illinois, and it didn't work. The Morris, Illinois Midwest reprocessing plant used a hybrid system, which used both the aqueous acid process and a fluoride-based process.
Gaseous fluoride or not molten salt?
No, it was a gaseous process because the idea was that it would take the recycled uranium and deliver it as uranium hexafluoride, which could then be shipped directly to the enrichment plant. Mm-hmm. And the idea was it would be an economical way of building small reprocessing plants to handle the fuel from a small number of reactors instead of having to have a big plant to handle fuel from like 100 reactors.
Yep.
Because at the time, nobody knew how fast nuclear power plants would be installed. Fact is, in the 1970s, 1980s, we went from having like 10 to having 100. So it grew much more rapidly than expected. But originally, people were saying, well, we want to build a small reprocessing plant because the nuclear power industry is probably going to be small for a while. Anyway, so the Morris plant was meant to do that. And as it turned out, because it was a small plant, the different stages were very closely coupled to each other. And the result was that if any stage was running a little faster or slower than the one behind or ahead of it, the whole process broke down. And when you have that kind of close, a molten salt reactor with attached reprocessing is going to be like that even more so.
Yeah.
So you really, really have to have your flow sheets very well established. In other words, you have to really understand the chemical process very, very well, and have a lot of experience with it. How do you get that experience? The only way I can see to get that experience is in running a molten salt-based reprocessing plant that's not coupled to the power grid.
Yeah. I hear you. That's a good way of looking at it. I never thought about it like that before.
Yeah, it's a whole systems approach.
Yes, absolutely. A systems approach is the kind of approach you absolutely have to take. You know, I mean, I'm gonna tell you, you know, if you want policy prescriptions for the United States out of me.
That's depressing because that's never going to happen.
molten fluoride at hundreds of degrees.
Like, I don't think we got it in us to be able to do that sort of cooperation on that scale.
We kind of do need a new era of...
On that note, how long until I get a nuclear power plant in my basement?
Are you gonna make it? I'll help you.
Sure.
We might die, but
no,
early.
Safety first. Right. We have workers do it.
Safety fourth.
Forced.
Forced.
Safety forced. You would be safe.
Maybe if you flood your basement, it can't be too bad.
Hey, that happens every rainstorm anyway. Oh, wow, that's...
Turn your house into Fukushima, dude.
Right?
Boom!
Just flood that basement. You're like, you know what? It's contained. It's underwater.
What happened, Joe? I had a buildup of hydrogen.
So, believe it or not, the Canadians actually designed a heating reactor. The slowpoke energy system, which would basically be a flooded basement,
like an RTS or something.
It's not a, you know, it's not a radioisotope heat source like they use in space probes. It's an actual reactor. Uses slightly enriched uranium and light water coolant. And anyway, the way it's designed is it's totally enriched. Self-regulating. Mm-hmm. It's totally self-regulating, and you just have a basically like a well about 10 meters deep, and you put it at the bottom of this well, and the reactor stays at...
What's the projected power output of such a thing?
So the reactor stays at 80 degrees centigrade all the time. So you basically then have a heat exchanger in the well that takes that heat out and delivers it to your heating system.
As it gets hotter, does the reaction actually slow down?
Right. That's the key. In fission reactors, there are several phenomena.
They start to heat up, and then their reaction rate goes up, and it keeps getting hotter.
So in most fission reactors, there is a series of phenomena which damp down the reaction when the temperature rises. So in other words, you get what's known as a negative temperature coefficient of reactivity. There's also a negative power coefficient of reactivity, where if the reactor starts generating more power, it actually damps the reaction down. Fission reactors, there are several different phenomena, physical phenomena, which cause this, which is one of the reasons why it's fairly easy to build a stable power reactor and fairly difficult to build an unstable one, although the Soviets did manage it. But the key thing is...
That's what you can do spirit.
Yeah. So in the slowpoke energy system, they were designed to handle heating loads up to about 10 megawatts. So... essentially, it'd be totally self-regulating, and however much heat you take out, that's the amount of heat it generates, just to keep the water in the pool at a constant 80 degrees centigrade.
All right.
Wow.
But yeah.
You'll have more hot water.
Yeah, man.
But yeah, so 10 megawatts was basically the top.
We can install a hydronic system in your house.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, 10 megawatts was basically the highest power.
You have no idea how down I am to do this. I already got 100 volts.
But yeah, the idea was to use them for big heat loads like Arctic mining camps or universities, big shopping malls.
Right.
But the thing that one of the things that killed the slowpoke energy system was the big money users would have been somebody like Arctic mining camps, which they have a lot of in Canada. They're big users of diesel fuel. But the thing was, the Arctic mining camps, typically their heat is provided partly as a byproduct of generating electricity in big diesel engines. And so they wanted to be able to generate electricity as well as heat. And there was a method that was developed for basically using a Freon steam engine, but it wasn't very favorable.
So they could do it at low pressure without having a whole lot of heat.
Works. Yeah, so
Stirling engine.
Yeah.
NASA has actually been working with Los Alamos to develop something unfortunately referred to as kilo power, which is a Stirling engine attached to a basically bare metal nuclear reactor.
Yes. You get just like a jalopy nuclear reactor. Cool.
The jalopy of nuclear reactors.
Yeah. But that's another case where it's very self-regulating. Basically, the reactor consists of a uranium sphere with a plutonium slug inserted in it, and the uranium reflects the neutrons into the plutonium. It becomes critical. If it heats up too much, the uranium expands slightly, more neutrons escape than are reflected, and it cools down again. So it's another very highly self-regulating, strongly self-regulating reactor. Of course, you can't produce very much power from this.
No.
So about a kilowatt is about as much as...
You don't want to be in the same room as it either. Didn't some guys die from something like that happening?
Oh, dropping the...
Yeah, dropping the
two halves of the uranium together? Yeah, because the guy did it for like a split second, but then he like...
Criticality accidents.
It was a spherical center and two half spheres on the outside.
Yeah.
And the screwdriver slipped.
Yeah, for a split second. And he was fine for 3 days, and then his guts liquefied.
Ugly ways to die. Yeah, throwing yourself onto a nuclear, onto a bomb core that's undergoing flash criticality takes you a month to die, and it's painful.
Yeah,
and
this kind of slow
because
cell death.
With a fucking screwdriver, you have to jump and go whack.
Now, what I'm kind of curious about is if you start having like house and residential sized setups going on, you will have the redneck that goes downstairs and goes, I bet you I can get another 20 watts out of her.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not enthusiastic about home heating reactors. On the other hand, now, neighborhood heating reactors are another story. I mean, the French developed one called Thermos that was, again, never used. The Swedish, one of the first nuclear power plants actually built outside the United States anyway, United States and Great Britain, was called Augusta. And I have a really nice chart of that. But anyway, Augusta was a combined heat and power plant. They built it for a new suburb of Stockholm. And it was built in a cavern excavated underground. And then they transferred, they had a hot water pipeline running to the suburb. And anyway, it ran for about 10 years. And then in the early 70s, it was shut down on the grounds that it was less economical than oil heat. Well, of course, it was a prototype. It was never intended to be particularly economical. But the thing was, that was 1972. Winter 1972-73, the people in the suburb were really mad because they had smoke where they never had it before, because now they were burning oil. Winter of 73-74, they were really pissed off. Because the price of heating oil had gone up by a factor of four.
Yes, of course, because of the OPEC.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting for.
Yep.
But unfortunately, by that time, the heavy water from that reactor had been sold to the Canadians, so they couldn't restart it.
They couldn't make their own deuterium?
You mine it, or you know, suck it out of the ocean.
Yeah, well, the Canadians at the time were buying every scrap of heavy water they possibly could to start up their reactor plant at Pickering. Of course, later on, they built a Bruce plant, which actually had a heavy water factory on the grounds so that they could produce as much as they wanted. But, you know, there's been, by the way, I'd like to point out, there's been a lot of enthusiasm recently for what are called small modular reactors.
Sure.
Which are pretty cool, okay? I'm not going to say they're not cool, but the big requirements in the world today are for big reactors because they're for cities, right? Give you an idea. Say your small modular reactor is 80 megawatts. That's the size of the biggest marine diesels that are being built today. Well, Pickering was 8 550-megawatt reactors. So to replace the 8 Pickering reactors, you'd need 55 of those small modular reactors. At that point, it starts to sound like less of a good deal.
That's true.
You know, and so I'm more interested, you know, I'm interested in, well, I guess what you'd call the low-hanging fruit. I mean, I absolutely do want to see, you know, small modular reactors. Where are they really good for? Well, ship propulsion is one, right? You look at something like the Ever Given, right? Again, 80 megawatts on a single screw. You know, 100,000 shaft horsepower on a single screw. Can you even imagine the size of that diesel engine?
I can imagine it.
It's piston like a silo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a diesel engine, which is, you know, basically the size of downtown
Think
Catskill.
Think about the emissions of all of them. Just,
yeah.
Oh.
Only when they put the bunker fuel in there.
As you can smell it from miles.
I mean, small modular reactors would, I guess, make the system at the grid as a whole more resistant to attack.
Yeah, it'd be more decentralized.
Yeah, you could decentralize the system more.
I mean, the thing is that in any power system, you can look at sort of what the smallest, what the largest and smallest reasonable unit sizes are, right? In any power system, for example, you don't want to have a single turbo generator which is bigger than 10% of the total system load. Mm-hmm. That's a bad thing, because if that goes offline, it'll bring the rest of the system down in a cascade of failures.
Yep.
Yeah. Northeast failure, what?
Cascade.
2008 or something like that? Yeah.
Sounds like a good time. Like
so that's one boundary.
Cascade of failures.
Well, those were intentional. Those were like shutdowns on purpose. They weren't like a natural cascade like what happened in the Northeast when that Canadian transformer blew and then everything went out except. Everything went out except Caro.
Really?
For real?
Yeah. Germantown, New York.
And it was funny. That was the only time, like, we would turn on the TV, and the broadcasters are like, they're literally sitting there like, we're on, but no one is listening to us. You're all out. And that's when they started getting weird. They're like, we know we're not being watched.
Oh,
and
I'm like, watching.
I'm watching. Yeah. I still have power. All of Caro had power. Not Catskill, not Hudson, not Greenville.
How did they get power? Was it from the Athens plant?
I don't know.
It must be.
There was something.
The only switch that happens that was working.
Although, like, if you have, like, a large industrial generator, you can actually sell power back to the grid.
And so some local thing might have been powering.
I think we had a power plant somewhere feeding us.
Maybe you were. Maybe it's because of your proximity to Glaxo.
Maybe a few of those would have powered their local.
The Glaxo place. Before it was Glaxo.
Well, this was, like, Catskill. My house had power. And Caro.
So the big Northeast blackout of the 1960s, Long Island still had power because Long Island was all diesel generator power plants, basically little diesel generator power plants. And The thing was, the automatic protection relays tripped up and down the East Coast when the, you know, the Sir Adam Beck plant at Niagara went down hard, and then there was this cascading failures. Well, there was one guy on Long Island who was watching. It was the power plant was too small and shabby to have automatic controls, so they had a guy watching the meters, and his meter suddenly pegged all the way to one side, telling him that he was trying to power all of New York City with his one horse engine, and he says, "Holy crud!" and pulls the main breaker to disconnect from the grid, and so his system is now disconnected from the grid. It's an island. It's fine, working just fine. And so the next guy in Long Island connects to him and starts up his generator. Next, and so Long Island had power. And so after several hours, they were able to use those little diesel generators all up and down Long Island to restart the power plants in the New York City area.
Hmm. Wow.
Of course, at MIT, it was even more embarrassing because the city power system called up MIT and said, "Hey, we know you have a generating plant on campus for your electrical engineering students, which also supplies campus power. Can you hook us up?" They said, "Actually, it's down for the weekend. We were doing maintenance, but we can bring it back up."
They actually have a nuclear power plant on MIT's grounds.
They do.
A reactor, not a power plant.
Yeah.
Research reactor doesn't generate power. But they did have, what they did have was a small, like, vest pocket steam power plant, and so they were literally, they sent people out into the parking lot to pop the hood of every car in the parking lot. They jump started the steam power plant from car batteries.
Holy shit.
And then they used that to start up the municipal power plants.
That's awesome apocalypse ingenuity.
That's beautiful.
All right, everybody, pop the hood. Don't cross the streams.
But yeah, the load dispatcher at you know, for the commercial power system called. He knew, you know, of course, he had telephone, right? Because the telephone was all battery based. He called down to MIT and said, "I know you've got a power plant." They said, "Yeah, but it's offline because we were doing work on it. We can bring it back up in a couple hours, though." Anyway, so, you know, again, talk about workarounds. But yeah, I mean, like I say, the thing people don't necessarily realize about small power units in the U.S., there are quite a lot of small diesels, particularly across the Midwest. But if you look, the U.S. EIA, Energy Information Agency, again, one of those things that's really easy to get confused about.
Good seeing you too.
Have a good night, Ben. Thanks for
Good night, Ben. Thank you.
So USEIA has a map of all electric generating facilities in the country and electric transmission facilities and substations, all that stuff. And you can select. And I was just looking. I got a friend in Northern Nevada, right? That nobody lives in Northern Nevada, right? But I was looking at the electrical power system in Northern Nevada. And there you got 500 megawatt coal plant.
Dead hookers.
500 megawatt coal plant, 800, 1,000 megawatt gas burner. Right? So even in places with really low population densities, as it turns out, there are these big electrical generating plants. Yeah, there are also some in Nevada and Utah that are like 70 megawatts or something. But seriously, you could take out, Pyramid Lake. Let's just say Pyramid Lake in the Paiute Indian Reservation. Pyramid Lake, you could drop in a couple of gigawatt-size reactors, and all it would be enough to do would be to take out the existing coal and gas burners in Northern Nevada.
Hmm. That's still a worthy goal.
Yeah, I actually do have this argument that we should be talking to the Indian nations and building nuclear power plants on Indian reservations, which sounds insane, right? But I'm not crazy. I'm not afraid to sound crazy. But the idea behind it is, firstly, so we say, okay, well, if you're going to provide the land for this, you get a 20% ownership stake, which means you get 20% of the electricity, and you can either sell that or use it, right? Now, Pyramid Lake, particularly, one of their major businesses of the Paiutes is fishing, right? People come to Pyramid Lake to fish. Well, hydronic heating, right? You got a nuclear power plant there, produces all the heat you could ever want. So you run hydronic heating lines to the fishing cabins.
Mm. There you go.
Fishing, yeah. Right? Fishermen are going to love that. Also, of course, to your own village, right? And your own community centers,
all
right?
The monies.
But the second stage is, and this is my own personal cheat on this, for years, the level of Pyramid Lake has fallen because the Bureau of Reclamation diverts part of the water from the Truckee River to do these irrigation projects in central Nevada, which have always been kind of marginal. Well, if you put a nuclear power plant on there, you can, on Pyramid Lake, you can say, oh no, we need you to stop diverting that water so that we can have plenty of water for the nuclear power plant. Well, what happens then? Level of Pyramid Lake rises. There's more habitat for those fish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody's happy. Except the, you know, dirt, except the farmers, irrigation farmers outside, you know, outside Fallon, but I don't even care about
it. Anyways, irrigation farmers, I mean, with the way the droughts happen out west.
Yeah.
The entire
move to where the water is.
Exactly. Go farm where the water is.
But yeah, well, I mean, actually, that's a big thing right now. I don't know if you've heard about this. There's a big controversy over the three lowest dams on the Snake River just before it joins the Columbia. And, yeah, so it's proposed to remove these three dams because it would really improve, at least this is the principle of the thing, they say it would improve the salmon fisheries, which is a big deal, and by improving the salmon fisheries, it would help to save the orca population because the Pacific Northwest orca populations are really suffering. Oh. They suffer from want of food.
Yeah.
Okay. So the idea is we improve the salmon fisheries. The orcas are happy. Okay. Only trouble is those three dams between them generate about 1,000 megawatts of electricity. And there's a lot of demand for electricity right now, as you might have noticed. Particularly because there's an intertie. Million volt DC line connects Bonneville with Los Angeles. So Southern California is actually drawing on Pacific Northwest Hydro. Now, what's the implication here? Well, the implication for me is if Trojan, the nuclear power plant in Oregon, had not been shut down, you could take those three dams out immediately and not worry about it. If one of the unfinished WPPSS plants, nuclear plants in Washington State, had been finished, biggest default, by the way, biggest public utility default in U.S. history came when they stopped building those plants. Anyway, if one more of those had been finished, only one of them was finished out of five, if one more had been finished, again, you could take out those dams and not worry about it. If either of San Onofre units 2 and 3 in the San Diego, Los Angeles area were still online, you could take out those three dams and not worry about it.
Wait, San Onofre, was that taken offline?
Okay, so San Onofre, it's an ugly story. I'm going to tell you the ugly story. So San Onofre Unit 1, about 500 megawatts, was built in the 1960s. It was the first large PWR power plant in the U.S. Yeah. It suffered from a lot of teething troubles. It operated under temporary operating licenses for decades, literally. The government kept coming back and requiring them to shut down and do upgrades. Shut down and do upgrades. Okay, 1990, they got their permanent operating license, good for 20 years. They could run until 2010. Practically the minute that they got that permanent operating license, the California Public Utilities Commission told them they had to shut down because they weren't going to be allowed to recover rates. You know, they weren't wasn't going to be included in the rate table. Sorry, we don't think this unit is large enough or economical enough. Based on, of course, past performance when they kept having to shut down for modifications. They had their permanent operating license. They could have run for 20 years at virtually no cost. But they had to shut down instead. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Okay, so in the 80s, San Onofre Units 2 and 3 were constructed. Okay, San Onofre Units 2 and 3. So after 30 years of operation, basically, 25, 30 years of operation, there are certain components you have to replace in a nuclear steam power plant, typically. So the type of pressurized water reactor power plant, they went ahead and replaced the steam generators. Yep. Now, new steam generators, which typically allows you to uprate the power plant, actually increase your output. The steam generators they got from Toshiba had a problem. There was, and this is a thing that happens, vibration caused by the flow of water through the steam generator tubes caused fretting, which caused small leaks to appear. Now, this is a leak between the primary circuit, which is where the reactor is, and the secondary circuit, which flows through the steam turbine. Now, secondary circuit is still isolated from the environment by the condenser, but so there was a leak of about a teacup's worth of water a day.
You're very snappy.
I'm
sorry,
snappy.
Chris. It looks like we're starting to like wrap up around here.
I'm sorry. I'm really out of it.
I think we're gonna wrap up and start heading out, man.
Okay, that's fair. You know, I can talk for a year, so that's, you know, not important.
Oh, we appreciate it. You were really good tonight, man. This was a good subject too.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
I just got to be careful not to steamroller people too badly.
We also take the lazy route here and let you just go.
All the questions that we put out there, so.
No, man, we look forward to having you on again.
Incredibly fascinating. I was like in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
You know, well, anytime you want me back, I'm here, so.
All right, brother.
Awesome, man. We will have you back on. Yeah. All right, man. Yeah. Have a good night. Right. Thank you very
much.
Good night, Chris.
Peace.
So, I'm what? You don't gotta Edward do it now. Does. I'm just saying that
I have to fit them on you, and I'm going.
It's all right. Do you want to just see them?
Sure.
See what they are?
Sure. All right. What's the problem?